Years ago, I got over my head. I was your preacher, and I was over my head. And I kept having people come to me with things I couldn't solve. And so I thought, maybe I need to take a few counseling classes. And so I quietly enlisted in a small college that did whatever you call that, distance learning, to do some serious counseling study. And you would watch a few videos online, and I know that videos 25 years ago were not, video college was not a thing 25 years ago, but I vividly remember a story that came out. It was, the classroom section was crisis counseling, and how do you help those people who have just been in the midst of a seriously traumatic event, and they walk into your office or you walk into their home, and how do you handle that? And so John Claypool, who was one of the ministers who was teaching that class, tells this story. He says, in my very early days of ministry, I'd gotten a call to come to one of our family's homes. And in the midst of that family home was this story. Guy came home from work. He'd had a lousy day at work. He was already angry. So he went the first place he could think of to dispel his anger, and that was the liquor cabinet. And after spending some time at the liquor cabinet, he found out that really didn't dispel his anger. And then his wife said something that made him even madder. And he said, I'm leaving. I'm out of here. I'll be back before the sun goes down. And he stomped to his car, and he threw his car in reverse and backed up and ran over his oldest child. And then I got called. And so the minister is telling this story as I'm sitting across a kitchen table with a man who just ran over his oldest child. And I have no words. Because never in my life have I seen someone with greater guilt and greater remorse and more despondent. And I needed to learn how to help people with emotional wreckage. Okay, I hope that we don't have many in this room that deal with emotional wreckage. But I'm not naive. And I know looking out, there are all of us who have had traumatic experiences at some level. And maybe they weren't to the level of the story John Claypool is describing. Maybe they weren't to the level of things that were horribly sinful going on in homes. Maybe they weren't to the level of losing a child. But we've all probably had moments where we were emotionally a wreck. And the truth is when we live in a world like we live in, those kind of things unfortunately happen. What I noticed a few weeks ago on that Friday when we had hundreds and hundreds of people coming through our parking lot to get just simple things like water and food is we had a bunch that were dealing with some emotional wreckage. There wasn't sin involved, and there wasn't a crime involved, and there wasn't a murder involved, but there was wreckage. And our three intake ladies were so gracious and so generous, and as they're coming through in their cars, their eyes are filled with tears, and their face is stained with those tears and mascara that have been just raining down. And they were dealing with some emotional wreckage. And I love how our three ladies handled it. Our three ladies were so comforting and so gracious and so loving and so willing to pray in English and Spanish, in whatever language you needed it prayed in. And they spent so much time just consoling and giving help. And maybe you've been there. If you haven't been on the side where you need the help, you've certainly been on the side where you can give it. And so I hope maybe we can approach both of those angles this morning in our sermon about Hope Rises. In the story of Acts, there is one character that is woven all through it. He doesn't really enter into the story until about chapter 7, but from there forward, he's integral to the rest of the book of Acts. And we will call him Paul most of the time. But that is not his first name. His first name, at least in the story of Acts, is Saul. That's his Hebrew name. That's what his parents would have called him. That's what his Jewish teachers would have called him. And he is as passionate as anybody has ever been about the cause for God. Not the cause for Christ, as the cause for God. And so he has made it his mission, because of how he reads the Old Testament, that this whole idea of Jesus is a fraud, and all of those who are following Jesus, calling themselves Christians, they too are frauds. And Saul, in his passion and in his zealousness, I don't know if zealousness is a word, but let's pretend it is, has said, I will do whatever it takes to fix this. And so being the leader that he is, he's got quite a following. And so among his following is a group that are out there trying to stamp out this little thing called Christianity. And we see Saul standing there holding the jackets, which doesn't mean he was the servant. It means he was the boss. And he is there as they are all ready to throw rocks at Stephen as he preaches a sermon about their failures as Israelites and how Christ has come to redeem. And then chapter 8 of Acts tells the story of how Saul has got to, in his back pocket, he's got the letters to go out and basically do whatever he wants to those who follow Christ. And his desire is to threaten and to imprison and maybe even worse than those things. And then we get the Damascus Road story. And something happens there that my guess is brought some emotional wreckage. And so I want us to look at that story for just a few minutes and see what we can learn from Saul, who's going to become Paul, who's going to meet Ananias, and then eventually in the story is going to meet a man by the name of Barnabas who will encourage him beyond belief. So that we, in the midst of our wreckage, can find hope. And we, in the midst of those who aren't in a wreck, can help those around us find hope. So let's just read just a little bit together from Acts chapter 9. I just want to read the story, and then we'll refer back to it a few times. But Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogue at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Now as he went on his way, he approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven shone around him, and falling to the ground, he heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And Saul said, Who are you, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. But rise and enter the city, and you will be told what you are to do. The men who were traveling with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. So Saul rose from the ground. Although his eyes were opened, he saw nothing. So they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And for 3 days he was without sight, and he neither ate nor drank. Now there was a disciple at Damascus named Ananias. And the Lord said to him in a vision, Ananias. And he said, Here I am, Lord. And the Lord said to him, Rise and go to the street called Straight, and to the house of Judas, and look for a man of Tarsus named Saul. For behold, he is praying. And he's seen a vision of a man named Ananias come in and lay his hand on him so that he might regain his sight. But Ananias answered, Lord, I've heard much about this man and how much evil he has done to your saints at Jerusalem. And here he is, he has this authority from the chief priest to bind all who call on your name. But the Lord said to him, Go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to carry my name before the Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. For I will show him how much he must suffer for the sake of my name. So Ananias departed and entered the house, and laying his hands on him, said, Brother Saul, the Lord Jesus appeared to you on the road by which you came, has sent me, so that you might regain your sight and be filled with the Holy Spirit. And immediately something like scales fell from his eyes, and he regained his sight. And then he arose and was baptized, and taking food, he was strengthened. Okay, I was looking back in my notes, and about a year ago, you heard me preach the story of Ananias. So you've heard me talk about this story from Acts chapter 9, but I want to look at it this morning from a completely different angle. And that is the angle of what happens to Saul. Because I think there has to be a little more that goes on than what we get in the text of Acts. And maybe there are some things that will point to those. When I think of this story of Saul of Tarsus, a couple things come to mind that I think all of us need to bear. And the first is that you have a future in spite of your past. Okay, let's just look at the laundry list of what Paul has done up to this point. He's been the ramrodder of getting rid of Stephen. No telling what else he has done. He's been this one who is adamant against the Christian faith. He has, in many ways, spurned the God that he thinks he was serving. And yet God is going to say, he is going to be my vessel to go the gospel everywhere. And I think that matters. Let me read you something. No matter what you've done, no matter where you have been, no matter what you were, you still matter to God. Okay, if there is any one note I want you to take from this lesson this morning, it's this. No matter what, you matter to God. Just like we talked about in the prodigal son story last week, and I'm grateful Brandon kind of brought us back to that because we're going to see pieces of that this morning as well, is that son mattered to the father. Even though he was far away doing things he shouldn't do, he mattered. And I want to say, you matter to God, no matter what you've done. Okay, this is going to make me look bad in a second. One of my favorite movies of all time, and I have not watched it because I'm embarrassed to have it pop up on my screen saying, movies that you've watched, it doesn't sound as bad as it's going to sound, is a little movie called The Lion King. I love that movie. We didn't even have kids, and I loved that movie, and then that was one of the first movies I wanted Jonah to watch, and most of us have probably seen The Lion King. It's about the lion who's got the great voice, and Darth Vader's voice, oddly enough, and he gets killed by the bad lion, and the son thinks he's the one to blame, and you've got this goofy little baboon monkey that holds up the lion, and that's what I do when babies are born, is I do the Lion King, little Rafiki, and the older lion is dead now, and the younger lion is trying to come to terms with this, and the baboon takes his stick and he whacks him on the back of the head, and he says, "The past is the past." Sometimes let's just be honest, I want to whack you on the back of the head like that baboon and say the past is the past. Now that's easier said than done. That some of you can say, well, your past might have been like this, but here is my past, and my past is vastly different than your past, and I want to say the past is the past, and you have a future in spite of it. Because Saul does. And God's going to use him in ways that are unimaginable. The second thing that comes out of this text is that Christ is gracious. In the midst of this story, you've got this crazed, obsessed Pharisee who is doing everything he can to stamp out the very thing Christ gave his life on the cross for. And if we were in the one that he's trying to stamp out, our reaction would be, the best way to fix this would be get rid of him. And Jesus says the best way to fix this is to turn him. And we see the gracious hand of Christ. We had a small group a number of years ago, and we were talking about grace, and one of the guys in the small group made this illustration, and I wrote it down because I thought it was so neat. He said, grace is more like an artist studio than a spelling bee. Okay, I can neither be artistic or spell, and so I had to really listen closely. In the spelling bee, you make one mistake and you're out, right? You spell despondent wrong. I'm going back to a fourth grade bad memory. You spell despondent wrong, you're done. In an art studio, the artist gets the brush and he keeps on working. That maybe there was a line that was off kilter or maybe the wrong color was there, but the artist then says, that doesn't spoil the painting. How do we figure out how to make this look like it's supposed to? And I think you need to know that. That too many people who have sat in church all of their life look back and say, hold on a second, I got this, or I got this, or I have this moment, or I had this failure, and they look at that wreckage that was in their life, and they let that deter them and miss the grace of God. And the story of Saul that turns into Paul is the story of Christ and his graciousness from beginning to end. Because the easiest way would have been to stomp out Paul with a big old foot and mash him into the ground. But instead, Jesus is going to turn him. And the idea is that God would rather work on us through Christ and take our wreckage and take our baggage and take our sin and our mistakes and things that we did to ourselves and things that were done upon us and things that we had no control over whatsoever. He would rather take all of that wreckage and spin it like the artist does into something beautiful. God keeps on doing that. We have an interesting word right now in our culture. It's kind of a catchphrase, not just among churches, it's kind of a catchphrase among all of those who are trying to deal with something in the past. And that word is recovery. And I like that word. There are some great recovery ministries going on in this town that help the addicts, that help those dealing with alcohol abuse or drug abuse or sex abuse or addiction. Sorry, let me fill in all the right words, and I wasn't using the right words. But the Bible doesn't use the word recovery. The Bible uses the word healing. Now, I'm a big fan of 12-step programs. In fact, if you've come to me with an addiction, I have probably sent you to a 12-step kind of like program. Now, they may have not called it a 12-step program like they did in the old days where you sat around and drank old coffee, but it was a program based on similar premises. But I need you to have more than a program. Can you find healing in a program? Probably. Can you get rid of a substance abuse in the midst of a program? Probably. But ultimately, I think not only do you need a system, but you need a Savior. Not only do you need a system that helps you figure things out and helps you make things right in your life and helps you get those addictions under grasp, but you need to be reminded of someone who's going to save. And when I think of Saul, I think of that story of someone who is going to save. Because I want all of us to have healing. From whatever it's from, whether it's addictions or whether it's problems that have been done to us or whether it's things that we have done to our family, I want all of us to have healing in our life. And so I think we need to take four really simple steps that I take out of Saul's story. The first step is you got to face your struggle head on. Okay, here's what I mean by that. Saul didn't blame someone else. Saul didn't say, well, Gamaliel, my teacher, he was the one who told me we ought to stamp out these Christians. He didn't blame mom and dad. He took it on his shoulders. And he also didn't minimize it as if it didn't matter. Those are two of our tendencies, right? We take those things that have happened to our lives, whether we've done it or someone else has done it, or they're just part of living in a fallen world, and we either start blaming everybody for what happened. Well, it was his fault or her fault or their fault, or fill in all of the blanks. It was weather's fault. Or we say, well, it wasn't all that important and it really didn't matter that much, when deep down it's killing us. Saul does neither of those things. And I believe the church, and I believe this church, is full of people who have issues, which ought to remind us that we are a hospital to help sinners and those who are struggling heal. This 2 months, we've talked about your depression, we've talked about your addictions, we've talked about your struggles, we've talked about your fears, we've talked about the things that make you anxious. And the whole goal of this series was, I kept thinking, we've got to get real about some of these things. Maybe they're not great theological messages, but they're things that are clubbing our people, and we've got to get real about them. And I think we've got to get real about our struggles, and we've got to face them head on. Not try to pawn them off. Not try to pretend they never happened. Not try to just gloss over them with fancy words, and not to blame everybody who's to blame. But just to say, how can we address it? Which leads to the second thing. I think we have to believe and receive. I had an interesting comment. Oh, it was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. Someone was in my office, and these were their words. I think God is out to get me. Okay, that was the tone. And I said, He is. I said, I knew it. And I said, I don't mean the same way. Then I quoted 5 verses. Let me quote them to you again. John 3:16 reads, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son." 1 John 4 reads like this, "This is the love of God who made manifest among us that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we have loved God, but that he has loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins." Or Romans chapter 8, verse 31 starts, "What will we say against these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for all of us, how will he not also graciously give us all things?" So when that guy is sitting in my office and he says, "God is after me," and I agree with him, and then he gets mad at me because I agree with him, and then he suddenly sees that God has been after him a long, long, long time. Okay, if you have that feeling that God is after you, good. He's not necessarily after you to go like this. He's after you to grab you, to hold you, and to turn you, and to move you the right direction that you need to go. And those things matter. So we've got to believe and to receive. But another thing, I was angry a couple nights ago. And I don't get angry very often. I have my place in my house. I have my big giant chair that is now broken, which bothers me as well. But I have this big giant chair, and I have this little light, and I've got my little table, and I keep my Bibles under there, and I keep my goofy stuff in the drawers. And I went and I turned on the light switch, and the light switch didn't work. And what's bad is I don't really have a temper except about silly things. And my temper just comes out and says, a stupid light that I bought on Wayfair that I paid way too much money for that was pretty, it's not even working. And I look behind it and it's not plugged in. Things work better when they're plugged in. Okay, I do not think you can get through wreckage in your life by yourself. So the third point goes like this. Walk it out. In the story, Saul starts walking it out 3 days later. For 3 days, he spends those 72 hours, give or take, thinking about what on earth is going on. Whose voice was that I'm hearing, even though I think he knows it's Jesus? And what's going to happen next? And am I going to be blind for the rest of my life? And then two characters enter the story. One that we see, Ananias comes in, and Barnabas will come in later. Okay, if you are going through emotional wreckage, however that you want to define that, do not try to handle it on yourself. Do not try to do the American way that says, buck up and say, I've got this. Because I don't think you do. Being plugged in matters. Over and over, in fact, I need to one day just read my New Testament and start just making little ticks and counting out how many times Paul and Peter and Jesus and all the rest of the authors of the New Testament say things like are, not A-R-E, O-U-R, or we, or us. If you're in the midst of emotional wreckage going on in your life and you can't quite get a handle on it, part of that is probably because you're trying to do it yourself instead of lean on somebody else. The first thing I do when someone comes to me and they're in a bind and something bad has happened in their life is I start thinking of people who have either helped others in the midst of that or who have been through it themselves or at least could give wise counsel and could sit across the table from them and have a cup of coffee. Because they need someone to walk with. And you can't walk it out if you're not plugged in. The writer of Ecclesiastes gives maybe the most famous verse out of Ecclesiastes. It reads like this: although a man may prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him, and a cord of three is not quickly broken. You want to know what Solomon's point is? Can't do it by myself. And if I got someone next to us, that's a little bit easier. And if I got two or three around us, that's even better still. Don't try to do it alone. Don't try to tackle what happened to you as a child alone. Don't try to tackle floodwaters invading your home alone. Don't try to tackle a marriage that is in chaos or a child that has gone off as a prodigal or a job that has been lost or a diagnosis from a doctor or the loss of a parent or a spouse or a child or fill in all of those other blanks. Don't try to do that alone because you're just going to be miserable. But find somebody to walk it out with. This time of year, we sleep with our window open in our bedroom, and for some reason, to get to the park to do the walking path, you kind of walk by our house. And I'm amazed at some of the stuff I hear, because lots of people are out there walking, and so they'll be talking about their dogs, and they'll be talking about their kids, but every now and then, at 7:30 in the morning, I will hear some pretty frank conversation. Sometimes I wished I didn't hear all of it, but what I find fascinating about it is those two women are walking it out together. They're trying to solve the problem in their marriage, or they're trying to solve the problem with their children, or they're trying to deal with past hurt and past sin. We got to walk it out with somebody. But then the fourth thing is we've got to focus on progress and not perfection. I think the best invention of the 20th century was the microwave. Stick a bag of popcorn in there. You put 2 minutes, 52 seconds, because if you go 53, it's going to burn. You hit start. You turn on the TV. You get the game all ready. You get your soda poured. You come back at 2 minutes and 52 seconds, and you grab that popcorn, and you shake it up, and you open it, and instantly you have popcorn. God hates microwaves. God would rather use a crock pot. Some of us are crackpots that are in God's crock pot, because he's going to take the slow way. As much as we want instant healing, I want to get over this addiction. I want to get over this sin that I brought into my life. I want to get over what's been done to me. I want to get back to life as normal when floodwaters came. And we fill in all of those blanks, and sometimes God wants to say, just hold on for the journey a little bit. And let me teach you, and let me love you, and let me have my people teach you, and my people love you, and let me have you walk through this journey and see what you learn. And we want it fixed instantly. But that's not the way it works. But I'll be honest, everything that Nikki's ever cooked in a crock pot is always better than my over Redenbacher popcorn, because it's taking its time. See, I want what happened to Saul to happen to us. That when we can look back at the worst things in our life, and Paul does this, and he'll say things like, I was the worst of sinners. And he'll say things like, here's the list of stuff I did. But then he'll also be the one forgetting that and pressing on toward the goal. That Paul could put in a box, here's what I've done. Here's what it did to the world. And here's the bad stuff that it done. And certainly there was guilt and remorse tied with that. But then he could say, here is the grace of God. Here is the one who is forgiven. And here who's the one who is chased after me down a road to Damascus and from that point forward. And I think he does the same thing for us. My favorite part of the airport is when you get rid of the bags. You lug in those bags, and you got the bag of clothes, and then you got the briefcase. And then if you got kids, you got all the kids' stuff, and you get to that line, and you get your little ticket, and you tie those things around, and you hoist up the 50-pound bag to the lady that's half your size who throws it like it's a banana peel. And you lay it down, and you walk to Terminal A in the Roswell Airport, and you're free of that. I want us to live our life walking to Terminal A without the baggage. With lessons learned, certainly. With problems fixed, certainly. With stuff under construction, certainly. But with a bag that has been left in the handler's care to do what needs to be done. Every time I've tried to handle my own baggage with God, I have failed miserably. But every time I've been willing to let it go, every time I've been willing to hand it to him, to have somebody that I love and appreciate and walk with help me carry it to the altar and say, God, you take care of it, he has always, always, always brought healing. Maybe not the way I anticipated, maybe not even the way I asked for, and maybe not as fast as I wanted it done, but looking back, he has always done that. Okay, I'm going to be honest. Some of our healing may not come this side of heaven. You may have something in your body that's not going to work. We talked about that a few weeks ago. You may have stuff that you just can't quite get all the way out of your brain that happened to you when you were young. But I guarantee the other side, God's going to fix that too. But how do we live in the midst of it? I walked into one of our sweet lady's houses about 6 months ago, and she had in her kitchen this little plaque that said, let go and let God. And I thought, that's catchy. Maybe I'll use that. Let go. Let God. I know some of you are going to say, easier said than done. You don't know, and you're right. But my call is still, let go and let God, and grab somebody else's hand to help you. We call this an invitation. It's changed in the last course of the 50 years. The invitation to me means find somebody right next to you if you need to. If you're in the midst of the wreck, there's going to be elders at every door. I'm going to be here at the front. Grab a hand for accountability. Grab a hand for prayer. Grab a hand for wisdom. Grab a hand for whatever you need. Maybe you just need to find someone who's got the same problem as you and join together. I found it so interesting last week when we were talking about prodigals that there was a group of three parents all wrestling with their prodigals, and they were all huddled together in the foyer, and they all had their heads down, and they were all praying for each other's kids. Walk it out. So if you need me, if you need elders, if you need someone from this church, find them. And I hope they will be more than willing to receive what you have to say. I know I will, and I know the elders will. So let us know as we stand and as we sing.